This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome to the world of Forbes, Barron's, and Fortune magazines. This is brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization. My name is Greg Conroy. So let's get down to business. Starting off with Forbes magazine, The Chili on Air. Tajin founder Horacio Fernandez turned his authentic Mexican seasoning, made with nationally significant heritage peppers, into a $1.5 billion spice giant by selling to Americans. This is written by Chloe Servino. Surrounded by the mountains of Jalisco, Mexico, the entrance to the 20-acre manufacturing headquarters of chili spice maker Industrias Tajin features a half-mile-long driveway lined with Montezuma-bald cypress trees. Halfway there, it wraps around a massive molcajete, a mortar and pestle weighing 70,000 pounds made from a single piece of volcanic rock. Three giant flags, 26 feet long by 13 feet tall, fly over the glass headquarters. One has the Tajin logo with its signature chili pepper substituting for the eye. In the center is the Mexican flag, and to the left is the Stars and Stripes. To see such a huge symbol of America 1,000 miles south of Houston is somewhat disorienting, unless you know the backstory. Quote, "The American dream motivated me," close quote, explains Horacio Fernandez, the 66-year-old founder and CEO of Tajin. Quote, "You build the business with your work, with your mind, with your innovation. In Mexico, it's difficult," close quote. Fernandez created the seasoning blend 40 years ago in his kitchen, taking cues from what his grandmother used with the goal of selling genuine Mexican flavors in the U.S. market. It was an audacious plan in an era when some American supermarkets didn't even stock jalapenos. And Chi-Chi's, founded in Minneapolis, was among the country's most popular, quote-unquote, Mexican restaurants. He succeeded by creating a Mexican product aimed squarely at Americans while simultaneously helping preserve, through commercialization, the heritage pepper key to Mexico's national identity. Chile de Arbol de Jalisco, featured in Tajin's logo. Some 40 million pounds of Tajin is now sold in America annually, much of it at Walmart, according to the cowboy hat-wearing Fernandez, who rarely gives interviews. The U.S. is the engine behind the brand's cult-like following, making up 60% of its business. Forbes pegs annual revenue for Industrias Tajin at $300 million, with gross margins of as high as 70% and net margins of 30%. We estimate the business to be worth $1.5 billion. Fernandez, who started the company in 1985, and his brother Aldo, who joined 11 years later, owned nearly all of it. Sergio Arias, a banker who became CFO in 1996, has 3%. Since 2020, Tajin has grown sales at a compound rate of 15%, some three times faster than the overall $7 billion U.S. spices category. Fernandez says Tajin, which has been licensed by brands ranging from Taco Bell to Hellman's Mayonnaise, has been wooed by Nestle, Conagra, Unilever, and Kraft. Yet he hasn't been tempted to sell. Quote, "It's not about the money," close quote, says Fernandez, who has spent some of his wealth on a school celebrating traditional Mexican ceramics, as well as a colonial-era hacienda built in Jalisco in 1564, purchased in 2021 for events. Tajin is, quote, "category-defining, like Kleenex," close quote, says Matt Leeds, who founded Forward Consumer Partners after having led the deal for McCormick to buy Cholula hot sauce in 2020 at private equity shop L. Catterton. Leeds says Tajin checks all the boxes, quote, "addictive and craveable," close quote, while being, quote, unquote, "very versatile." Quote, "the brand is underexposed," close quote, he adds, quote, "there are not many companies this scale, this profitable, with strong brands, their own manufacturing and independently held," close quote. When McCormick, the $6 billion seasoning behemoth behind Frank's Red Hot and Old Bay, acquired Cholula, it spent 10 times revenue for a total of $800 million. Since then, deals in spice brands have ranged a bit lower, from 4 to 8 times sales. Last year, Siete Family Foods, the corn-free chip maker that expanded into seasonings and hot sauce, was acquired by PepsiCo for $1.2 billion, or more than 4 times sales. Quote, as a brand, what Tajín is doing is meaningful. It's powerful. Close quote, says Siete's co-founder and CEO Miguel Garza, who grew up in Laredo, Texas. Quote, it felt for so long like this is a Latino thing, but now I go to my Whole Foods in Austin and they have Tajín, and it's sitting right next to the fruit, close quote. Tajín grew through grit. Fernandez was raised in Guadalajara, one of seven kids of a wealthy gasoline entrepreneur, but he wanted to strike out on his own. Without help from his father, he started more than 20 small businesses, hawking everything from leather goods to candy. Each one failed, but Fernandez kept looking for the idea that would take off. While selling beans and rice, he attended a food trade show in Chicago. There, in 1980, he had an epiphany. He would bring chilies to the masses. It took a whole year for Tajín to sell its first 200 cases. Fernandez dreamed of breaking into America from the beginning, but he spent the first 8 years growing sales in Mexico at a snail's pace. By 1993, when Tajín finally made it to U.S. grocery stores and supermarkets, its annual revenue was less than $10,000. Even though sales were tiny, Fernandez didn't have any debt, not even a company credit card. He funded the business entirely from profits. In 2002, emboldened by his American dream, Fernandez moved to Houston with his wife and five children. It was a huge risk. Sales were just $130,000 the year prior. He personally drove cases of Tajín around Texas in his pickup truck, offering tastes to Hispanic grocers and convenience stores. Fiesta, a Houston-based supermarket with 48 stores, was an early adopter, as was Texas' favorite HEB. Then in 2004, he landed Walmart. Sales doubled every 2 years, but it wasn't enough. As retailers like Trader Joe's copied Tajín, Fernandez needed to grow bigger, quicker. Quote, we had a lot of competition, close quote, he says. His plant was hitting capacity, producing around 7.5 million pounds of Tajín annually, but Walmart wanted more. So he spent $50 million from his own savings and a small loan to build a plant that was 8 times larger. It opened in 2020, and sales at Walmart have since soared. They now make up 50% of Tajín's revenue. There's still plenty of room to grow. Only 7% of American households bought Tajín last year. That means there are still a lot of tables Tajín can hit for the first time. One idea is to hook 'em young by selling to American public schools. Individual Tajín seasoning packets launched in 2015 have caught on. Kids like to sprinkle the powder on boring broccoli and carrots. Tajín now has 552 school districts under contract and delivered more than 55 million low-sodium sachets last year. It hopes to double that by 2030. Next up, brick-and-mortar retail stores. Of course, the flagship shop for this very Mexican brand will be in America. Fernandez is even investing in regional U.S. peppers after acquiring New Mexico's famed Hatch Green chili brand Palitas in 2022. After all, it took him 8 years in Mexico to reach more than $10,000 in sales. He now does that in less than an hour in America. No wonder he's all in on the USA. Here's a sidebar from the vault, bringing the heat. Horacio Fernandez began taking Tajín to the American masses in the early 1990s, the same time that century-old spice giant McCormick, with a 2025 market cap of $20 billion, was reigniting its business with hotter packaging, fiery sales tactics, and blends for U.S. palates. Quote, Buzz McCormick has cashed in on a growing preference among Americans for highly spiced food. Cajun blackened redfish and enchiladas, verdes, require a lot more spices than the baked flounder mom used to make. As Americans curb their intake of salt and marbled steaks, they increasingly resort to garlic powder, red pepper, and other spices to add flavor. Overall, U.S. per capita consumption of spices has almost tripled since 1965 to 3.1 pounds a year. Sales and profits are booming. The company founded 101 years ago when Willoughby McCormick concocted root beer and fruit syrups in his Baltimore basement will sell an estimated $1.3 billion worth of spice and other goods this year and earn about $65 million, close quote. That was from Forbes magazine of November 1990. Continuing in Forbes magazine, Lone Wolves by Hank Tucker. Sezzle didn't have the war chest to take on big money-losing buy-now-pay-later competitors such as Klarna and Affirm, so it opted for faster profits by charging frequent users a hefty fee. Then the short sellers took aim. This was written by Hank Tucker. The future looked grim in mid-2022 for Minneapolis-based Sezzle, and also ran in the fast-growing buy-now-pay-later fintech business. It had burned through most of the $115 million it had raised in a 2019 initial public offering on the Australian stock market and two subsequent offerings. A rescue deal it had struck to be acquired by a competitor was collapsing, along with both companies' stock prices. And when Tiny Sezzle tried to sign up big retailers, it had to make too many concessions to ever turn a profit. A problem because the typical buy now, pay later transaction, which allows online shoppers to pay for purchases in 4 installments at 0% interest, relies on subsidies from merchants. Meanwhile, investor enthusiasm for money-losing fintechs, which surged during the early days of the pandemic, was evaporating. Venture capital funding for the sector fell from a record $141 billion worldwide in 2021 to $39 billion in 2023, per CB Insights. Quote, we were reaching a techpocalypse with interest rates rising, and investors were thinking, quote, we've got to look at the fundamentals of companies, close quote. And our fundamentals were not great, remembers Charlie Youakim, Sezzle's 47-year-old CEO and co-founder. To survive, he started chopping. He shuttered the company's operations in Europe, India, and Brazil, cut worldwide staff from 580 to 240, and began shedding unfavorable partnerships. He even trimmed headcount in the U.S., the heart of Sezzle's business, by 10%, and made symbolic changes like canceling the $500 a month contract for a fancy bevy machine that dispensed carbonated and flavored water at headquarters. Up against much bigger and better funded competitors such as San Francisco-based Affirm and Sweden's Klarna, Joachim couldn't simply cut his way to survival, let alone profitability. He needed a new revenue source and strategy. He found both by focusing on the niche of heavy users, chronic buy-now-pay-later addicts. In 2022, Sezzle launched a $12.99 a month subscription service aimed at these frequent flyers, with benefits including access to more retailers and flexibility in rescheduling payments. Those opting for the premium quote-unquote Sezzle Anywhere pay $17.99 a month and can use 0% installment buying at physical stores and restaurants, too, by loading a virtual Visa card into their phones. In all, Sezzle has 529,000 subscribers. That $17.99 monthly charge works out to $216 a year. That's expensive when a host of credit cards charge no annual fees and pay cash back on all purchases. But many buy-now-pay-later users don't qualify for the best credit card deals. A recent study by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau found that most buy-now-pay-later loans are made to borrowers with subprime credit scores, and that heavy users are more likely than other Americans to have outstanding student and personal loans, in addition to their credit card balances. 3/4 of Sezzle's users are Gen Z or millennials. Here's another way to look at Sezzle's offering, which gets mixed user reviews online. Credit cards now carry an average annual interest rate of 21.5%. Using that average, $216 is roughly the interest someone carrying a constant $1,000 balance on a credit card would pay in a year. Sezzle won't disclose the average outstanding balance subscribers have. Surprisingly, it doesn't give subscribers a credit limit. Each purchase is approved individually, the company says. It's safe to say $216 is a steep price for infrequent users, but for the heaviest users of Sezzle Anywhere, the top 10% make an average of 10 transactions each month. It may be worth it. With subscriptions bringing in a growing share of revenue, 33% in the 3/4 of 2024, Sezzle has been profitable for more than 2 years. For the first 9 months of 2024, it reported $53 million of net income on 57% growth in revenue to $173 million. By contrast, Affirm, which went public in January 2021, lost $279 million on $1.9 billion in revenue during the same 9 months. Klarna, which is preparing for a U.S. initial public offering, lost $10 million in the first 9 months on $1.8 billion in sales and is finally turning quarterly profits. It started its own subscription service in the U.S. last year. Both champions and skeptics have taken notice. Sezzle's stock, which listed on NASDAQ in August 2023, shot up 2,000% during the first 11 months of 2024. It has fallen 44% since, including 23% on December 18th, when short seller Hindenburg Research issued a report savaging Sezzle as a quote-unquote failing platform that had, quote, already been left in the dust, close quote, by bigger competitors and, quote, reported rosy numbers using short-term tricks, close quote. Its stock recently traded around $240 a share for a total market cap of $1.3 billion, making Joachim's 44% stake worth nearly $600 million. As Hindenburg points out, Sezzle's merchant roster has declined by more than half since 2021 to 23,000, while its active customer count is down 20% to 2.7 million. Quote, you should not be focused on keeping active customer accounts high at the sake of financial performance. I call them vanity metrics. The real metrics that matter are performance metrics, close quote, Joachim says, pointing to Sezzle's growth in sales and profits. This isn't Joachim's first startup. Minnesota-born and bred, he graduated in 1999 from the University of Minnesota with a degree in mechanical engineering and a knack for coding. He spent his 20s working for a parking software company before heading back to the University of Minnesota in 2008 for an MBA. Graduating in the wake of the Great Recession, he found job prospects limited and started Passport, his own mobile parking payments company, in Charlotte, North Carolina, with a cousin. The company was successful, but the cousins butted heads. Joachim was pushed out at the end of 2015. Wanting to stay in payments, in 2016, he founded Sezzle with Paul Paradis, a business school buddy who wanted to stay in Minnesota. They raised $1.8 million in a seed round and in 2017 launched a product that aimed to lower transaction costs for merchants. When that fell flat, Joachim drew inspiration from Afterpay, an Australian-born buy-now-pay-later startup. Afterpay entered the U.S. market in 2018 and was bought by Block in 2022. With Afterpay, Affirm, and Klarna already in the field, VCs weren't interested in backing Sezzle. So Joachim sold his stake and Passport to Bain Capital Ventures for about $12 million and invested $8 million of it into his new company after taxes. That's basically all he had. An analyst suggested he do a roadshow in Australia, where it's more common to go public at early stages, leading to a $30 million 2019 IPO. Despite being public, Sezzle was way behind its rivals. By 2019, Affirm had already raised $1.1 billion in debt and equity at a valuation of $2.9 billion. Plus, it had buzz. It was run by Max Levchin, a PayPal co-founder, making him an OG member of the PayPal mafia, along with Silicon Valley royalty Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, and Reid Hoffman. In 2020, Joachim made his first bid to distinguish Sezzle from larger players with an optional free service allowing users to have their loan payments reported to the credit bureaus Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion to help build their credit history. Buy now, pay later lenders haven't traditionally reported to the bureaus, and reporting could even lower a consumer's score if it looked like they were taking out lots of personal loans. Sezzle's solution is to aggregate a user's transactions for each month and report it as a single revolving line of credit, like a credit card. Credit reporting wasn't enough to differentiate Sezzle. By February 2022, it was running short of cash again. Sezzle's stock had tanked 80% in a year to $2 a share amid rising bad debts and assertions by a local fund manager that it was hiding negative information. That's when Sezzle agreed to be bought for $300 million by Australian competitor Zip, a deal that fell apart 5 months later. One current issue flagged by Hindenburg, the push for subscribers has caused Sezzle's customers' default rates to rise from 1.2% in 2022 to 2.3% in the third quarter last year. Joachim waves this off as a natural consequence of growth. It's worth noting that buy now, pay later users have much lower default rates on these loans than on their credit cards because lenders like Sezzle require that borrowers set up automatic repayments, either from their bank accounts or through charges to their credit cards. In other words, the buy now, pay later companies buck some of the default risks to the credit card issuers. Hindenburg, which ceased operations in January, raised other issues with Sezzle. One is that Joachim has pledged the majority of his stake, some 1.7 million shares, worth around $400 million, as collateral for a margin loan. Joachim insists that what he has actually borrowed is a tiny fraction of that and that he simply wanted a little personal liquidity since he has never sold a share. He has been as frugal personally as professionally, he says. He doesn't own a car in Minnesota, walking 2.5 miles each way most days to Sezzle's office, and still lives in the same home he's owned since he started the company, though he spends most of the winter in Puerto Rico. He chose the Sezzle name, a mashup of sell and sizzle, in part because its domain name was cheap. After spending just $4.4 million on marketing and advertising in the first 9 months of 2024, Sezzle is loosening its purse strings a bit. In August, it agreed to spend more than $5 million annually for 3 years to have the Sezzle name and rainbow-hued logo patched onto Minnesota Timberwolves players' basketball jerseys. The sponsorship deal also comes with 4 courtside seats at every home game to entertain partners and investors. Quote, "We knew it was time for us to do something a little bit splashier," close quote, says Joachim's co-founder, Paradis, who worked in sales for the Timberwolves in his first job out of college and oversees Sezzle's marketing strategy as its president. He points to competitors' efforts. Klarna, Afterpay, and Affirm have done billboards, and Klarna bought a Super Bowl ad. Timberwolves superstar Anthony Edwards looms on a billboard outside the franchise's Target Center with his Sezzle patch prominently displayed. After the team surprised many with its best season in decades last year, the NBA rewarded it with 25 national TV games this season, up from just 10 a year ago. Quote, "We're not a regional player," close quote, Joachim says. Quote, "We're looking for national impressions," close quote. Moving on to Barron's. Berkshire Hathaway once had a big silver investment. Too bad it was sold. The Civil Foray is one of several examples of former CEO Warren Buffett making a smart call, but then selling the investment too soon. By Andrew Berry. Berkshire Hathaway Chairman Warren Buffett is a longtime student of the silver market. The company made a sizable investment in silver in 1997 and 1998 when the metal was around $5 an ounce. The company purchased 129.7 million ounces of the metal, but sold out of the position within a decade at an unspecified profit. That holding now would be valued at about $13 billion, with silver trading at $100 an ounce. Silver has tripled in price over the past year, including a 40% gain so far in 2026. Buffett had followed the silver market for decades before the company purchased the metal in 1997. Quote, "I bought it very early. I sold it very early. Other than that, everything I did was perfect," close quote, Buffett said at the 2006 Berkshire annual meeting. Quote, "I was the silver king there for a while. We did make a few dollars on it, but we're not good at the game of, when it gets into the speculative area, figuring out how far a speculative boom will go," close quote. The silver foray is one of several examples of Buffett making a smart call, but then selling the investment too soon. He sold most of Berkshire's stake in Apple in 2024 and 2025 and a group of bank stocks in 2020 and 2021 at below current prices. Berkshire put out a press release in February 1998 saying it held the 129.7 million ounces of silver accumulated over a six-month period and that it had no intention of buying any more. The Berkshire purchases, which then amounted to about 25% of annual mined supply, attracted attention in the silver market and among regulators. There was apparent regulatory concern that Buffett might be trying to imitate the Hunt brothers, who drove up the silver market in the 1970s. The strategy worked for a while as the price of silver briefly rose to $50 an ounce before it collapsed. Buffett had invested in silver during the early 1960s, when the silver price was effectively set by the U.S. government at around $1.29 an ounce. That was the value of silver in U.S. coins minted before 1965, including dimes, quarters, and half dollars. Certain coins were 90% silver. There was roughly 0.18 ounce of silver in a quarter of that era. Buffett figured in the 60s that the government was artificially suppressing the price and releasing silver from a government stock to help keep down the price in the face of strong industrial demand that would support a higher price. Buffett turned out to be right when silver was demonetized in 1965 and the price went up. Berkshire Vice Chairman Charlie Munger marveled at the 1998 annual meeting about Buffett's investment breadth, insight, and patience. Quote, "Think of the discipline it takes to think about something for 3 or 4 decades, waiting for a chance to employ 2% of your assets," close quote. The Berkshire silver holding then had a value of less than $1 billion. That is typical of Buffett. He has encyclopedic investment knowledge on a wide range of asset classes accumulated over a lifetime of investing dating back to the early 1940s. It's notable that in 1997, Berkshire had holdings in the physical oil market, silver, and in zero-coupon treasury bonds. Before Berkshire bought insurer Allegheny in 2022, Buffett had read decades of its annual reports. Buffett saw a silver opportunity in the 1990s for much the same reason that investors now are buying silver. Demand was exceeding supply. Quote, "In recent years, widely published reports have shown that bullion inventories have fallen very materially because of an excess of user demand over mine production and reclamation. Therefore, last summer, Mr. Buffett and Mr. Munger, vice chairman of Berkshire, concluded that equilibrium between supply and demand was only likely to be established by a somewhat higher price," close quote, Berkshire said in the 1998 press release. That reads like the current bull case for silver. The Silver Institute has estimated a 2025 silver supply deficit of more than 100 million ounces before investment demand on mine supply of about 1 billion ounces. There was a deficit of about 150 million ounces in 1997. Continuing in Barron's, how financial advisors can use ChatGPT to work more efficiently without losing the human touch. Artificial intelligence can be a valuable tool for client communications and other time-consuming tasks, allowing advisors more time to focus on their core competencies. By Christopher R. Devaney. Thanks to artificial intelligence, financial advisors are facing a familiar tension with a new twist. Clients want faster responses, clearer explanations, and more personalized guidance, while regulatory scrutiny, documentation requirements, and market complexity continue to increase. Artificial intelligence, specifically tools like ChatGPT, is rapidly emerging as a practical way to relieve that pressure. For advisors, the question isn't whether to use AI, it's how to use it responsibly, effectively, and in a way that enhances, not replaces, professional judgment. It is important for advisors to cut through hype and fear alike, focusing on specific use cases that can help reclaim time while improving the client experience. ChatGPT should not be seen as a decision maker. It's best understood as a productivity assistant, supporting research, communication, preparation, and follow-through. Consider the daily workflow challenges advisors face, such as drafting client emails and portfolio talking points for meeting prep. ChatGPT can help draft clear, professional client communications in minutes, summarize lengthy documents or market commentary, and generate structured agendas and follow-up notes, always with the advisor firmly in control of review and final approval. ChatGPT isn't a replacement for due diligence or investment decision-making, but it is a powerful tool for idea generation, scenario exploration, and translating complex concepts into plain English. AI can help frame conversations around volatility, interest rates, diversification, and risk, tailored to different client profiles, so meetings are more focused and clients leave with greater clarity and confidence. Personalization is another area where AI delivers outsized benefits. Many advisors know what they want to communicate, but struggle to customize it for different clients that may include retirees, business owners, high net worth families, and next generation investors. ChatGPT can help adapt the same core message into multiple versions, each aligned to a specific audience without rewriting everything from scratch. Marketing and practice management tasks can also benefit from an AI assist. ChatGPT can draft newsletters, educational content, seminar outlines, social posts, and website copy while preserving an advisor's voice and brand. Be sure to focus on providing consistent, high-quality communication that supports relationship building and business growth, not on volume for volume's sake. Crucially, advisors must also remain conscious of compliance issues. Advisors need to incorporate practical guardrails, supervision considerations, and disclosure language. They should document review and approval processes. Rather than ignoring compliance realities, advisors can learn through trial and error how AI should be used day to day. Advisors also need to learn through experience how ChatGPT can fit into existing workflows, including working alongside CRM systems, planning software, calendar tools, and task management platforms. I suggest trying ready-to-use prompt templates, a quote-unquote swipe file of ideas, and a simple 30-day action plan to begin experimenting safely and effectively. It is critical for advisors to explore ways to work smarter, communicate more clearly, and provide personalized service without burning out. AI can help as long as you stay focused on your core competencies while remaining compliant and client-focused. ChatGPT can become a powerful ally in delivering better advice, one smarter workflow at a time. Continuing in Barron's, Latin American equities gain ground as global capital shifts closer to home. A growing list of South American stocks is not only outperforming their regional peers, but beginning to challenge leadership on a global basis. This is by Doug Bush. Strength continues to build beneath the surface in South American equities, with the region quietly emerging as a standout performer in the global market. While much of the focus remains on U.S. mega caps and developed markets, capital is increasingly rotating toward Latin American names, where strong relative strength and commodity linked tailwinds are driving renewed interest. From financials to energy and infrastructure, a growing list of South American stocks is not only outperforming their regional peers, but beginning to challenge leadership on a global basis. A notable driver behind this strength has been renewed capital inflows into the region as the U.S. increasingly turns its focus inward and toward its own hemisphere. This shift is showing up in price action, with improving liquidity and foreign investment flows beginning to reinforce the region's leadership across multiple sectors. The Global X MSCI Argentina ETF is trading near all-time highs. There was a 27% weekly gain the last week of October for the ARGT, and it is now breaking out to the upside. Price action has remained constructive since, with the ETF now pressing toward the around $100 level. Meanwhile, the Global X MSCI Colombia ETF has come out of the gate strong in 2026, posting three consecutive weekly gains between 6 to 7% and suffering just two down sessions all year, underscoring the persistence of demand across the region. Brazil and Mexico, two of the region's heavyweights, are enjoying powerful runs of their own. The iShares MSCI Brazil ETF is up 50% over the past year, while offering a dividend yield north of 4%, adding income to the performance story. The iShares MSCI Mexico ETF, up roughly 10% year-to-date, also deserves recognition for its steady advance. Beyond the headlines, lesser-followed vehicles such as the iShares MSCI Peru ETF and iShares MSCI Chile ETF have delivered eye-catching gains of 118% and 72%, respectively, over the past year. With momentum broadening across the region, let's take a look at three names poised for continued growth. Energy has long dominated the conversation in Latin America, given the region's heavy commodity weighting, and Vista Energy has been acting well within that theme. The stock sits just 7% below its most recent 52-week high, and while it remains down roughly 7% over the past year, momentum has shifted firmly in its favor, with shares advancing 33% over the last 3 months. The daily chart continues to act well relative to the broader energy space, as seen in the ratio versus the Energy Select Sector SPDR, which has been trending higher since the start of the fourth quarter. The 200-day simple moving average has begun to slope higher since the first half of 2025, suggesting the long-term trend is strengthening. On September 8th, the stock formed a double bottom with the April lows, marking the start of a strong uptrend. That name resolved higher on January 13th with a decisive breakout above the very round $50 level, clearing a $49.79 pivot, and price action has remained constructive since. Notice the pattern started after a 10-point pullback following a bearish dark cloud cover candle on December 4th, helping reset momentum before the next advance. I believe the stock can work its way towards $77 by year-end, representing approximately 45% upside from current levels. Remain bullish above $48. Next up, UPS stock jumps after earnings. The dividend is safe for now. UPS reported fourth quarter earnings per share of $2.38 from sales of $24.5 billion. Wall Street was looking for EPS of $2.20 from sales of $24 billion. This is written by Al Root. UPS has struggled with a choppy economic environment lately, but the stock was rising early Tuesday after better-than-expected quarterly numbers and a solid outlook for 2026 left investors hopeful that better times are ahead. Even the dividend was maintained. Tuesday morning, UPS reported fourth quarter earnings per share of $2.38 from sales of $24.5 billion. Wall Street was looking for EPS of $2.20 from sales of $24 billion. A year ago, UPS reported EPS of $2.75 from sales of $25.3 billion. For 2026, UPS projects sales of $89.7 billion and operating profit of $8.6 billion. Wall Street is projecting sales of about $88 billion and operating profit of $8.6 billion. Citi analyst Ariel Rosa called the results quote-unquote solid in a Tuesday report. Quote, the beat was driven by better-than-expected revenue in both its domestic and international segments, with particular strength in domestic ground volumes and international yields, revenue per piece. Close quote, he added. Shares were up 2.4% in early trading at $109.50, while the S&P 500 was up 0.2% and the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 0.7%. Sales declined partly due to tariff headwinds on shipping volumes, weak manufacturing activity, and less business from Amazon.com, while UPS walked away from, citing weaker profitability. Lower sales have weighed on investor sentiment. Coming into the week, UPS stock was down 19% over the past 12 months, trailing the S&P 500 by about 32 percentage points. Growth has been a struggle for the sector since a post-COVID shipping bump. UPS generated 2022 sales of about $100 billion and an operating profit margin of almost 14%. Sales in 2025 were $88.7 billion. The operating profit margin was 9.8%. Investors want improvement. It will take a while to show up. Evercore ISI analyst Jonathan Chappell noted in an earnings preview report that, quote, macro demand headwinds, close quote, and cost challenges from falling sales were reasons to be cautious. Still, some caution is already reflected in shares. Recent stock declines have left UPS shares trading for about 15 times earnings, down from a historic average of closer to 16 times. Along with an outlook for 2026, investors were looking for any comments about the dividend. Management maintained the quarterly payout at $1.64 per quarter. UPS stock yields about 6%, and the dividend costs about $5.6 billion annually, very close to what the company is expected to earn in 2025 and 2026, leaving little margin for error. There was also an update about the company's fleet of MD-11 jets following the tragic crash of a cargo plane in Kentucky in November. The planes aren't coming back, and UPS wrote off the jets, resulting in a $137 million charge. It had 28 MD-11 jets. Moving now to Fortune magazine. Get ready to own a tokenized portfolio by Jeff John Roberts. In early 2021, an army of retail traders made massive bets on meme stocks and briefly melted down the market. Trading volumes swelled to such a huge extent that popular brokerage Robinhood had to halt buy orders for stocks like GameStop for a few days in order to escape a liquidity crisis. At the time, the situation led to claims of a conspiracy, but the reason for the meltdown was more mundane. Wall Street's creaky infrastructure could not settle trades fast enough. Robinhood CEO Vlad Tenev and others called for an overhaul, and since then there's already been progress, as stock trades now settle a day sooner than in 2021. But the financial industry is also pushing ahead with a more radical solution, turning stocks into digital assets that can be traded and settled instantly on a blockchain. It's not just crypto firms and fintech players leading this charge for a tokenization. Big banks like JP Morgan are also using blockchains to facilitate trades in certain assets, and in doing so, transforming the financial ecosystem more broadly. Already, tokenization, which Tenev has described as a freight train, quote-unquote, poised to eat Wall Street, has brought fundamental changes to how stocks and other assets are traded. The potential upsides to tokenization are huge, but significant questions remain over how to implement it. Meanwhile, some fear the coming train could undermine some protections for individual, quote-unquote, retail investors and destabilize a U.S. equities market whose reliability has for decades been the envy of the world. The tokenization wave isn't the first push to overhaul Wall Street's under-the-hood operations. In the 1970s, traders confronted what became known as the, quote-unquote, paperwork crisis, which saw stock markets drowning in orders shut down midweek simply to keep up with record keeping. Repeated work stoppages finally led to a computer-based solution. Quote, once upon a time, there were leather-bound journals that said who owns all the stock, close quote, explains Robert Leshner, a former economist who now runs the tokenization from Superstate. Quote, then people said, this is too hard, let's not update anymore. So they decided to create a legal fiction that assigned ownership of all the stock to the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation, close quote, or DTCC. The DTCC regime, which has been in place for decades, means it's no longer necessary to record every single share transfer. Instead, the clearinghouse keeps track of the stock held by different brokerages on behalf of their customers and settles up transactions between those brokerages the next business day. Under this system, the brokerages nominally own the stock, but all the rights that attach to it, dividends, voting privileges, and so on, remain with the customers. The system has worked pretty well over the decades, and for those who insist on doing things the old-fashioned way, DTCC means they can still demand physical copies of their shares. This option is popular with quote-unquote GameStop truthers, who believe reverting to paper will thwart a Wall Street conspiracy against retail investors. Now, though, the current DTCC system of T plus one, quote-unquote, in which the clearinghouse closes out trades the next business day by reconciling accounts among brokerages, has come to feel outdated in an age when so much business is conducted instantly and around the clock. This has prompted companies like Leshner's Superstate to offer a faster alternative. The startup is working with companies to issue versions of their shares that trade on a blockchain, an arrangement under which the firms don't have to rely on intermediaries to hold or track their stock. It also means stock trades can be settled instantly while allowing firms to interact with their shareholders more directly. Other firms are approaching tokenization in a different fashion. Robinhood, for example, doesn't help firms tokenize their stocks, but instead takes stocks available on the open market and offers them in a blockchain, quote-unquote, wrapper, as a sort of derivative. These offerings are currently available only in Europe, where stock owners can buy and sell the stock tokens, quote-unquote, alongside assets like Bitcoin. Retail investors unfamiliar with tokenization may be surprised and possibly alarmed to discover that a company they own is trading in the cryptoverse. For now, at least, it's not something to worry about. Currently, even tokenization boosters say the new blockchain system will exist alongside the old one rather than replace it. So why do all this in the first place? For the average investor who trades only from time to time, the arrival of tokenized assets won't mean much. Active traders, though, will appreciate the move to blockchain since it opens the door for more trading after hours and on weekends. The new regime will also be appealing to institutional investors since it will free up collateral that might otherwise be tied up waiting for settlement. Quote, imagine you're a hedge fund and want to buy 1 million of Tesla stock, close quote, says Johan Kerbrat, SVP of Robinhood Crypto. Quote, you buy it on Friday, so you don't have the money anymore, but you don't get the shares in your account until Monday. So for 3 days, you can't do anything, close quote. It's not just stocks being tokenized. BlackRock's BUIDL fund, working with Superstate's tokenization rival Securitize, offers access to money market funds and U.S. treasuries via blockchain and has already grown to $2 billion in assets under management. Meanwhile, J.P. Morgan is offering tokenized versions of private equity assets on its in-house Kinexys blockchain, in part because the process makes capital calls easier to track and manage. This is likely just the beginning. Rob Haddock, a partner at venture capital firm Dragonfly Capital, notes that other realms of finance like credit and fixed income are still conducted primarily in pre-digital fashion, with some transactions still made official by means of a fax. A switch to tokenization could enable such transactions to settle faster and more reliably. Haddock says it will also produce savings for banks and brokerages, since it will reduce the ranks of back-office staff and disrupt specialized middlemen who handle tasks like loan origination and servicing fees. Meanwhile, for traders of all sorts, tokenized assets will be easier to move across brokerages or post as collateral. It is still early days, especially in the U.S., where the Securities and Exchange Commission has yet to give the green light to tokenized equities. As of mid-November, the total value of such assets worldwide was about $660 million, according to research site RWA.xyz. The most popular ones include tokenized versions of index-tracking ETFs and big tech stocks such as Tesla, Nvidia, and Alphabet. But that nascent state hasn't stopped brokerages from pushing forward, including crypto shop Kraken, whose tokenized versions of select U.S. stocks are doing a brisk trades in markets like Brazil and South Africa, where traders still pay hefty commissions that can amount to 10% or more, even as such fees have largely been eliminated in the U.S. Robinhood, meanwhile, got its hands on shares of privately held OpenAI and SpaceX and has given away tokenized versions of them to European customers. As for the DTCC, it would be easy to assume the clearinghouse opposes the tokenization wave. Quite the opposite. According to two sources familiar with the company, the outfit is eager to move into blockchain, partly because it offers a potential way to expand into private markets. Asked for comment, the DTCC did not provide details but did suggest it is embracing the technology. Quote, DTCC believes in the power and potential of tokenization to evolve and modernize market infrastructure. We are actively working to enable capabilities that further our products and services, close quote, said Brian Steele, DTCC's president of clearing and security services. Not everyone is convinced a rush to tokenization is a good thing. Those urging caution include Citadel Securities, which has asked the SEC to adopt a go-slow approach. According to a source close to the firm, the trading giant fears that some crypto-aligned firms want to use the rulemaking process around tokenization to gain exemptions from long-standing consumer protection obligations. The person also expressed concern that a rapid shift could undermine trust in a U.S. equities market that is the biggest in the world and has been fine-tuned for decades. This concern may not be unfounded. Already, there have been notably discrepancies between the prices of traditional shares of a company's stock and the prices of tokenized versions offered by the likes of Kraken. Meanwhile, it's unclear if every firm offered tokenized equities has put in place adequate guardrails when it comes to custody and fiduciary obligations to the customer. What happens, for instance, in the event of a crypto firm going bankrupt while holding tokenized shares of a customer's stock? And while every financial institution appears to view blockchain as the technology of the future, they may not agree as to which blockchain. Robinhood, among others, is relying on the open-source Ethereum chain to build out its tokenization business, while JP Morgan appears wedded to its own proprietary chain. According to Haddock, the venture capitalist, this situation could slow adoption since he says other big firms like Goldman Sachs will be reluctant to rely on a blockchain controlled by a rival. Haddock adds, though, that any impasse is unlikely to last long since, quote, one thing blockchains do well is coordinate trust, close quote. Continuing in Fortune magazine, terror threats and Gen Z sobriety have put Bordeaux on red alert, by Vivian Walt. In the tasting room of a Bordeaux winery, a photo on the wall shows a pastoral tableau, three generations of the Dubois family sipping wine on the patio of their Le Bertrand Chateau with their Australian shepherd, Namek, perched at their feet. Out the window, chestnut trees sway in the breeze, with sunlit vines stretching for acres beyond. It's this mesmerizing serenity that draws millions of tourists to southwest France every year to revel in the craftsmanship and lifestyle that have made Bordeaux wines an icon of the $515 billion global wine industry. Last year, the region produced 484 million bottles, about 14% of France's output, according to the Bordeaux Wine Council. Every 15 seconds, somewhere in the world, someone buys a bottle of Bordeaux. But the idyllic calm is deceptive. Amid the old stone villages and winding gravel roads, winemakers are reeling from a multitude of problems that feel largely out of their control, from geopolitics and trade tensions to the changing tastes of younger consumers. Traveling through Bordeaux, one thing seems clear. It will take more than the traditional Christmas spike in wine sales to turn things around. Quote, the crisis is very strong, close quote, says Laurent Dubois, who is 57, sipping espresso, not wine, one morning in the tasting room during a break in the harvest. Quote, we have never seen this, close quote. Until recently, Dubois believed his business had faced every imaginable challenge. He is the ninth generation to run Chateau Le Bertrand, which his ancestor François founded in 1692 in the village of Reynac. His family tree is displayed prominently on one wall, and his son Amaury, 31, has just joined the business as the 10th generation. The family has cultivated vines here through the French Revolution, the Great Depression, and occupation by the Nazis, who moored U-boats on the nearby coast, commandeered wineries, and cleaned out the cellars. But the threats this time might be more existential. Global wine sales and production are at their lowest levels in more than 60 years, according to the Paris-based International Organization of Vine and Wine, or OIV, which publishes the industry's benchmark data. Unveiling the 2024 figures this spring, OIV statistics chief Giorgio Del Grosso warned that the trend was the result not only of current economic and political pressures, but also, quote, structural long-term factors, close quote. While 2025 data has not yet been compiled, the organization is bracing for more disappointment. Since 2019, wine drinking worldwide has dropped about 12%. It has fallen even further in the U.S., the world's biggest wine market and Bordeaux's single biggest export market. Just 54% of American adults now drink alcohol, the lowest rate in 90 years, according to a recent Gallup poll. Even the French, who drink more wine than anyone else in Europe, are consuming 4.9% less than they did in 2000. And France's Professional Winemakers Association projects that consumption could fall another 20% over the next decade. In areas like Bordeaux, where the backbone of the wine industry comprises hundreds of small family-owned chateaux rather than big diversified corporations, these trends feel particularly destabilizing. Bound by tradition and lacking in scale, it's difficult for these winemakers to pivot quickly to new strategies. They're grappling with an unfamiliar question. Is a full comeback even feasible, or will they need to permanently overhaul their business models? Families like the Dubois are under pressure to future-proof their companies, and there's no telling how soon any solution could take root. In regards to threats by the president to levy tariffs in trade with France and the United States, communications chief Christophe Chateau shows me letters from the council to French President Emmanuel Macron and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, urging them to plead the industry's case directly to Trump. The survival of many Bordeaux wineries, the letter explains, depends on American sales. Quote, we're telling them, please, the U.S. is a huge market for us. Please find a solution, close quote, Chateau says. Among the many challenges analysts point to, the one that seems most worrying is this. Younger consumers are making dramatically different choices just at the age when they're forming lifelong habits. Consider that until 1981, French kids as young as 14 were served wine with their school lunch, a boon for the industry. But, quote, Gen Z does not drink as much as prior generations, close quote, says John Muramarco, managing director of alcohol consultancy BW166 in Broomfield, Colorado. Wooing new young xenophiles has proved intensely difficult, especially since COVID hit in 2020 and shut bars and restaurants for months. Many younger adults went out far less frequently after venues reopened. Their shrinking incomes have not helped. When Gen Zers do opt for alcohol, studies show that they prefer cocktails, canned hard seltzers, and more exotic, affordable wines from Latin America and even China over traditional vintages like Bordeaux. Gen Z also tends to skew more health conscious, and many are heeding new warnings against even moderate drinking. The industry faces challenges from the other end of the demographic spectrum, too, as the global population ages. Quote, people over 65 drink about 20% less than people between 50 and 65, close quote, Muramarco says. In France, of course, the crise is a far hotter political issue. The country's wine industry is focusing on cutting production to meet the industry's new reality. The government is seeking 200 million euros in EU funds to compensate wineries as they shrink. France's industry organization, CNIV, led by Bordeaux winemaker Bernard Farge, advocates ripping out 247,000 acres of French vineyards, about 12.5% of the total, to right-size output. Farge also wants to overhaul the complex appellation system in which each small wine growing area operates independently, thus reducing its marketing and distribution muscle. Quote, we're all dwarves, close quote, Farge told visitors at an agricultural fair in Paris. Quote, we need export champions. For now, winemakers like Laurent Dubois are left to find their own solutions. For centuries, old businesses like his, the choices are stark. Re-envisioning the future of a family tradition or accepting that the wine business might need to shrink significantly. To Dubois, each choice seems a painful recognition that this crisis might be irreversible. He says he plans to increase shipments from Chateau Le Bertrand to customers in markets where Bordeaux sales are growing fast, like Thailand, Cambodia, and Singapore. He also plans to rip out about one-fifth of his 320 acres of vines over the next 2 years, lowering output from 800,000 bottles to a year to 600,000. And he is rethinking the 50,000 bottles of kosher wine he ships yearly to New York, where demand has dropped as younger generations choose alcohol less steeped in old-world traditions, or no alcohol at all. Dubois says he is studying what else the family can cultivate, including planting olive, fruit, and nut trees. Moving forward, he says, quote, we will produce only the quantity we sell. You've been listening to Down to Business. My name's Greg Conroy. This has been brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization, helping the low vision and blind communities in the St. Louis region since 1973. Have a great week. Take care.